I still get confused when they say, "Will the defender please rise?" So that's all good. So I'm Cliff Gooding. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm sober since August the 15th of 2001. For that short amount of time, I'm as grateful as I know how to be. And I just can't thank you all enough for having me and inviting me out here this weekend to spend some time with you guys. And I was talking to Robert and Ed a while ago, and they were thanking me for coming. And I would say, dude, I'm already spiritually overpaid. I mean, just being here just a little bit, I'm already spiritually overpaid. I got to sit with Alan. Not where, there's my friend Alan right there. Got to sit with him tonight and share a little bit at the table. And it was just, I mean, I'm on the edge of crying. I'm already emotional, which means God's already here. How many guys first time at any at this retreat? I mean, first time guys. Yeah. How many guys first retreat ever? Yeah. Well, I'm sorry they couldn't get you a better retreat leader, but just apologize up front. It gets better because McHugh's coming next year. And he's one of my dear friends. You guys are going to love him. He's the real deal. Bad alcoholic, seriously. So, but here's some things I can tell you about this. I got this yesterday. John picked me up and from the airport and took me to my hotel. And then John came and got me last night to the West Side Men's Group, which was phenomenal. I had the best time there last night. It was just really good. I was just telling the guys how similar it is to my home group. My home group is a men's group. It's called the Altered Boys, Changed. And we meet for 75 minutes. It's hard to find groups that meet for 75 minutes. And we start out with what? Announcements. Because we got all this stuff going on in AA. And I'm sitting there last night thinking, I'm just like being in my home group. You know? And that's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, everywhere you go in AA, wherever you go, you can walk into a total room of strangers and start reminiscing. Yeah? You know? It's coming in here tonight to hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it. You come into a room like this, everybody talking, nobody listening. I love that. It's just like the bars. I mean, really. You just come in, it's the same kind of vibe, right? Everybody's here, and that's the stuff that attracts new people. And so today, Ed came and picked me up. I got to hear about police stories and DEA raids, all that. I figure about a third of it's true. It's all good. So we went and had this great lunch. I got to go to his house, look through his medicine cabinet, stuff like that. You know, it's good. It's good. And just had a great time. I got to meet Amy, who's lovely. And obviously, he outpunted his coverage. And that's the deal here. And then got to show up here. And just the conversation and coming out here, you know, when we turned into the center, when we turned into coming into here, here's what I know about that. You know, when we turned in, I just got this feeling that something's going to happen this weekend. And it's the same sense, the same feeling I get every time, whether I'm just coming to a men's retreat or have come to being asked to lead it. It's the same feeling I get every time. Something's going to happen this weekend. And the guys who've been to this retreat, another retreat like this, you know what the deal is. I mean, you know that God's coming. Absolutely, God's coming. And the deal about it is that I'm kind of an incidental bit player to the whole weekend. I'm something to fill up like 35 to 40 minutes of time. But the real magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, the real magic of this weekend is not going to happen in this room. Or there might be something to get a conversation started. But the real magic of Alcoholics Anonymous is going to happen, maybe not even necessarily in the small groups, but it might start there. The real conversation, the real message of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it's really going to come in this weekend, is when you get permission to give yourself permission to tell your roommate or the guys you're riding with the thing that's getting you. And some that breaks you open this weekend. That's the hope of every retreat, is you find or you hear something or you give yourself permission to be broken open. To share that piece of you that, you know, that's just either on your heart, on your chest, or maybe it's that piece you've never given yourself permission to talk about. That's what these weekends are about. And so, you know, what I encourage people to do when they come is take full advantage of that. And I know a bunch of guys got your cell phones out on the table. This is what I would tell you to do. Leave them in your room. Come here and be fully connected this weekend. Come when you get in here, when you get your... Leave your phone in your room. I'm not the boss. I'm just giving you a suggestion. Leave them in your room and be fully present in the room. Give yourself an opportunity to have whatever God's got for you, whether it's here or it's in your small group. Give yourself the opportunity to be present in the moment. In the moment. Because the thing about it is, it's the one place a guy like me could never be. It's in the right here, right now. In the right here, right now, I never fit in, I never measure up, I'm different from, I'm separated. I suffer from that spiritual malady that our textbook talks about. You know, I'm that deal. And here, this weekend, you get an opportunity, particularly for the new guys, you get an opportunity to have something transformative begin to happen in your life. And so I just want to encourage you all to be there. So my job this weekend is pretty simple. We're just going to have a conversation. And we're going to do that over through about five sessions. And I don't know where it's going to go. I hope I have an inkling of where it's going to go. But the real deal here is that I want it to be God-led and God-centered this whole weekend. These are called spiritual retreats for a reason. This is not about me. I mean, it could be if I fall over with a heart attack, the deal is somebody could come up here and pick right up and never miss a beat. There's nothing special about me this weekend. It's just a job I have this weekend, you know. I'm honored to be the first guy from out of town to show up. That just means I'm an expert. You know, if you're out of town, you're an expert. First guy to show up out of town to do this. I'm honored that John thought of me. But the deal is here is that I just want everybody to participate in that conversation throughout the weekend. And that's what my sponsor always talks about, this idea that this is just a conversation. That we're going to start, we're going to carry it through the weekend and see where it ends up. I have a sponsor. It's a guy named Bob Bazance. He's going to be 56 years sober this year, this December 10th. Got sober a long, long time ago. He's in St. Paul, Minnesota. Has been my sponsor for a long time. And he's really good for me. And I hope you have somebody that's really good for you in your life. So, you know, I want to start tonight just talking about me growing up. I want to talk about what that looked like, what that felt like. And I think it's really important because what we have here, what all of us have been given here, whether you recognize it or not, is this incredible gift of recovery. This incredible gift we have. And I'm a firm believer that for a guy like me, I had to be made ready to receive the gift. I mean, if I was just able to receive it, I would have never been an alcoholic. I'd have just got it. And you all know people that just run around the world that just seemingly to know intuitively what the right thing to do is. I mean, we all know people in our lives that just seem to know from the very beginning, just know how that works. And I'm not that guy. I mean, I'm not a guy that intuitively knew anything about that. I mean, when I can remember way back in my life, it's just as a kid growing up, I had this pain of life. I mean, there's just pain of life. Life seems painful to me. And it's not because I had a bad home. It's not because anything happened to me. I just see the world differently. You know, growing up, how I see myself, my perception of the world is skewed. You know, even in my adult life, before I ever found Alcoholics Anonymous, I kind of see myself as this kind of, you know, Jim Morrison, Lizard King kind of guy, you know, just kind of this rebel. And really, I'm kind of like Eddie Munster, is the truth. But how I see myself, my perception of it, you know, how I view myself and how I view the world, you know, if you would have, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you would have said, Cliff, make a list of the top 25 problems in your life, selfishness, self-centeredness, they don't ever make the list. I mean, when I get here, I mean, those would have never come to my mind. Selfishness, I'm not even sure those are problems when I get here. You know, I'm not even really sure because the deal is, you know, I need to get mine. I need to get mine before you. As a matter of fact, I need some of yours too, right? That's the kind of deal here. But I got this pain of life. I'm vertically challenged most of my life. When I was a kid growing up, I was always the smallest kid in school. And so I was picked on all the time. I mean, good-looking guys like Brian, they picked on me all the time, you know. I was always the smallest guy in school, so he just picked on me. Picked last for everything. And I would have told you before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to do an inventory that I was picked on because I was small. I was picked on because they just wanted to pick on me. But the truth is, like, I'm picked last for the sports. I'm picked last for all that kind of stuff. And I wasn't picked last because I was poor, that I was short. I was picked last because I'm not a good athlete. I mean, that's just the truth. If I'd have been a good athlete, they'd have picked me first. I mean, that's just the truth. But my perception of that, how I perceive life at that spot in my life is different, and it's my reality. You know, how I view my life in that moment is my reality. And so I got this pain of life. And what happens for a guy like me, and believe me, what I'm telling you, none of this stuff makes me alcoholic. None of those things make me alcoholic. The things I'm about to tell you, they're just things that happen to me. And I know you have things that happen to you. You got things that happen to you growing up that may be different from mine. And none of that makes us alcoholic. But I'm a guy that'll hang on to that. I'm a guy that'll hang on to that. And if you suffer from a spiritual malady, that separateness, that different from, you just hang on to it and it fuels the fire. It fuels the fire because I can hang on to things like, well, if I had his family, if I lived in their house, if I had his brother and sister, if I had those clothes, and it just goes down the list from the time I'm a kid. It just goes on down the list of all the things I can point to why my life is bad. And the truth of the matter is, I've got a really good life. I never really wanted for anything. If I look at the external circumstances of my life, I really had about everything I ever wanted. And if I didn't get it, I just pestered my mom and dad till they gave it to me, right? I mean, I really did. If I look at people's circumstances in my life, I really had it pretty good. I had everything I really ever wanted and particularly ever needed. But what I do is I measure how I feel in here with how you look out here. And every time I do that, I'm losing. I was born in Texas. My family moved back to Oklahoma when I was 5. And because that's where they were from, my mom and dad. And my mom wanted to move home. And you know how this went. We moved home. And when we lived with my grandparents for the first year. And then my dad ended up buying the land that my mother's parents sharecropped. My mother's family were sharecroppers. They farmed for this 160 acres. My dad ended up buying that place, and we moved back to my mom's home place, except this time she was an owner, not just a sharecropper. And this little house, when you talk about shotgun houses, this was it. I mean, it was this one big room. It was a little dividing wall, and then they built this back part on. No indoor plumbing. 1968, I'm living in this little house with no indoor plumbing. And all my friends have that because I'm a country kid. Where I go to school in town, all those people have indoor plumbing. I can never have anybody come to my house. Can never do that. Why? Because I would be too ashamed. Because how that looks. I can't do that. I can't ever have nobody come to my house. I'm much too ashamed to do that. Finally, about 1973, 74, my dad had been successful enough. We had a house built on that same 160 acres, and then I began having people come over. And I'm going to tell you, I doubt if any of my friends would have had any trouble with that whatsoever, but it's my reality, my perception that I'm ashamed. Because again, I'm looking at how it must feel in here for me and look at how you live your life, and I'm losing. I can't have that. I can't let you see that part of me. I can't let you know that part of me because I've got to be something that what I think you need me to be. And so this pain of life and how this looks and how it goes in. And that's why I say I believe for a guy like me, I've got to be made ready to receive the gift that all of us here tonight have a part of, that all of us participate in. And if I don't, I'm a firm believer that everything that happened to me and everything that happened to you had to happen the way it happened for me and for you for us to be here today. That if there had been one thing changed in our life, maybe for the better or maybe for the worse, there's a spot that we don't get here. There's an opportunity that none of us be here to share in this weekend. You know, one thing bounced the other way, it's totally different. There used to be an old guy in California used to give a talk. He used to call it seconds and inches, that I'm just here by seconds and inches, that all of us are just here by seconds and inches. Norm Alpe, if you ever live a chance to hear some of Norm's stuff, listen to it. It's incredibly good. And I believe that. I believe that today I'm just here by seconds and inches. And I think what happens to a guy like me, when I get to some spot, there's something that has to happen to break me. I mean, there's something that has to come along that breaks me. And my perception of the world and how I see it are so skewed. You know, in step 3 in our textbook, it talks about that I want to be the director. And I'm going to tell you guys what that looks like in my life for me. From a time I can remember. You know, I'm a kid that, because I lived in a country, and I was really, my closest neighbor was like a mile away. So I have one brother. He's 10 years older. By the time I got up to enjoy him, he's gone. And so I'm really like an only child. And I spent most of my time reading, watching TV. I mean, I'm just absorbed by reading. I'm a prolific reader. I just read all the time, and I live in this fantasy world. Like, if it could be like this. You know, I'm a kid that would go get the cup towel with a clothespin, and I'm Superman running down the street, you know, just going, right? Just going. I mean, I just live in this kind of fantasy kind of world. And so because of that, here's what happens for me is that I think, you know, this selfishness, self-centeredness that I have in my life, I have this script in my head of how it's supposed to look. I have this idea about how the world is supposed to look and how I relate to it. And I think it's the best way to see it is if we talk about our romantic relationships. Because in our romantic relationship, particularly for me, I can really see when I begin to do a 4 and 5, I begin to really see when it talks about how the world really dominated us, I begin to see how you all disappointed me all the time. Because I have a fundamental idea when I meet you. So if I would meet a young lady within the first 10 seconds, I have our whole life planned out. 10 seconds. I look at her. She's kind of cute. I begin to plan our whole life out within 10 seconds. I got her, me, the house, a white picket fence, and 2.5 kids. I got the whole thing. And I'm alcoholic, so what I do, I take her hostage, man, just hostage. We go underground for about 60 days. We finally come up for air. And when we do that, we begin to circulate in the world, and I begin to notice some things. And I notice that when we're in a crowd of people, that she doesn't take my hand as quickly as the role calls for. Because, see, I'm a role assigner. When I meet you, I immediately assign you a role in my life. And I have a script for you of how this plays out. And so I have this role for her that how it's supposed to look to love me. How it's supposed to look if you're with me. And what I notice is when there's Christ, she doesn't take my hand as quickly as the role calls for. Now, if we just had this bunch of hairy-legged guys and you came into the room like this, I would notice immediately she doesn't stand as close to me as the role calls for. And in my head, what I begin to do is I begin to think, well, she just really doesn't care about me because she's not living up to the script. And so what I do is, you know, I do exactly what the book talks about. I'll be gracious and kind to try to get her to move to where I need her to move. And if she doesn't do that, I'll be an absolute dick to get her to move the place where she needs to move. And she'll want peace at any price, so she'll move. She'll move. And I don't know if you've ever experienced this or not, but she seemed to be the one at the moment. But come to find out, she was just right now. Well, she wasn't the right one. In about 90 to 120 days, I began to pick her apart. I begin to find all the flaws in her makeup. I mean, I'm just taking her inventory. Her hair's a little mousy brown. She wears those shirt plates. She didn't really dress right. I mean, I begin to pick her apart because she's not following the script. And I don't know about you, but when that happens to me, I begin to go interview some understudies because the starlet's going to be replaced, right? I've got to find some understudies. And so I begin to interview understudies. She finds out about it. When she finds out about it, she's none too happy with me. And see, she says, I'm out of here. I'm leaving. And what I say every time when that happens to me is good. Good. See, because I don't know how to sit down and have a conversation with people and say, like, you know, this just isn't working out for me. You know, I like you and I think we can be friends, but this is just not going to work. I don't know how to do that. You know, I don't know how to sit down and have conversation. So what I do is I just create a scenario where you leave. I create scenarios where you leave and I make it your fault. And what happens is she finds out about the understudies, and she says, I'm out of here. And you know what I say? Good. Good. You know why? You don't get it. You don't get it because you don't know how to follow the script. It's important to know we never share with people this what the script is. I never share with her how it's supposed to look to love me. But I bet you that somewhere in your life you've said something like, if you love me, you'd. If you really cared about me, you'd. But I just say that in my head. And I say, good, because you don't get it. And then what happens for a guy like me is, I think it's the greatest fear of every alcoholic. It's this thought that comes to me next. My God, I'm going to be alone the rest of my life. The fear of being alone. The greatest fear of every alcoholic, be alone the rest of my life. That means I'm going to have to sit in my house by myself for the rest of my life. I'm not going to have anybody. And it seems like, you ever notice this with alcoholics particularly, is that if something happens bad, it's going to be that way forever. Something good happens, I never think that. I never think, it's going to be good forever. only when it's bad, it's going to be this way forever. And I had this cycle of over and over what the 12 and 12 calls defective human relationships. Because everybody I meet, I assign them a role. They don't live up to it. It's just like the book says. It talks about what happens. I get restless, irritable, and discontented because you don't follow the script. You don't follow the role that's in my life. And I can't figure out why these people are not just doing what I want them to do. And that little piece, when you lay that script on top of how we perceive, I perceive my life, of how I see that, it just happens to me. And I think over and over and over, I'm just screwed. And I begin to think about all the wouldas, couldas, shouldas. You know, when I was 11 years old, some of you guys heard this last night. When I was 11 years old, my brother opened up a tall boy can of Country Club malt liquor. He took a big drink and he handed it to me. And that changed everything about my life. When I took that drink, it changed everything that I felt inside. All that separateness, that differences, all that stuff seems to melt away, just seems to go away. The book talks about it, this illusion that's created. You know, this illusion that's created that will chase that, chase the effect that produces in the real alcoholic. We'll chase it to the gates of insanity or death. We just roll with it. Because without that, you know, people talk about drinking problems. You know, people would say to you have a drinking problem. Because to the whole world, that's what it looks like. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous, when we recognize finally that it's this kind of illness and the medical association talks about it being a disease, when we talk about that, when they talk about the illness concept and the disease concept of alcoholism, Alcoholics Anonymous, what we do here is we do something different than the medical community does, you know, with whatever they have, whatever they're treating out there. Not alcoholism, but whatever they're treating is. We treat alcoholism different. We treat the symptom first. Because Alcoholics Anonymous says that drinking is but a symptom. And we treat that first. We got to get the alcoholic separated from the booze. Why? Because, hell, it's like if you die, you know, the results of an autopsy aren't going to help you. You're dead, right? But if we can get the alcoholic or the drug addict to stop drinking or stop using, then we can get down to recover from what's really got us. And in the step four, it talks about when the spiritual malady is overcome. When that happens, we straighten up mentally and physically. You know, I'm not a doctor. Alcoholic comes to me for help, wants to talk to me about the physical allergy. I can listen to that, but I got nothing for that. I got nothing to deliver to arrest the allergy of the body. I got nothing for that. I'm not a psychiatrist, a psychologist. I'm not a counselor. Somebody comes to me, they want to talk the mental obsession. I'll listen, but I can't do anything. I can't treat that. I got nothing for that. There's nothing I can do for that. But what happens here, we come here under this lash of alcoholism, and the only thing Alcoholics Anonymous treats is the malady. That's all we treat here. But in order to treat the malady, what has to happen for us is we have to get the sufferer to stop drinking or stop using. And so we treat the symptom first. We try to talk about relieving that person from drinking. Again, if they don't stop drinking, we can't help them. And everybody in this room is aware of that. Everybody in this room has had the experience probably of trying to help a guy that won't stop drinking. And there's nothing we can do for them. The book talks about that too. Says they keep drinking, leave them alone because there's nothing we can do for them. You know, maybe we want to spoil a future opportunity. And what happens for a guy like me is under the lash of alcoholism, I finally get surrendered in Alcoholics Anonymous. But there's some fundamental things that I don't know about me. When I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, there's some fundamental things I don't know about me that I've learned here through a process of the steps. The first thing that I've learned about myself when I got here that I didn't know is that I'm separated from God on self-will. That is the fundamental problem of every alcoholic. They are separated from God on self-will. The book bears that out. It tells us what our... If you suffer from alcoholism, you may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience can conquer. And so I don't know that I'm separated from God on self-will. And let me just say this. If you're one of those people here today, which is no judgment on my part, that if the word God gives you the heebie-jeebies, whatever when I say God, whatever you believe in, that's what I'm talking about. If you're a person that says you believe in the group, when I say God, just know that's what I'm talking about. That's exactly what I'm talking about. But I don't know that. I don't know that what I'm really thirsty for is a relationship with God. The terrifying part of a relationship with God is that I've got to learn how to sit in pain. Wilson wrote in the 12 and 12 that, you know, pain is the touchstone of all spiritual growth. And I don't know about you, but I don't like to be uncomfortable. I don't suffer well. I just don't. But the truth of the matter is that until I'm willing to get uncomfortable, I can't grow. I can't grow in my own comfortability. You know, I always tell my guys, I mean, I'm grateful. Home group every Wednesday night, I'm there. But I also know this, that I got to branch out and go to other meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'll get stale and get judgmental and get critical in my own home group. I got to go out to other places and do other meetings, go to other groups, just to be fresh. You know, staying in one place that won't do it for me. And if you're a guy that you get everything from your need from your one meeting, I'm not judging that either. I'm just talking about me. I got to go do something different from that. And I've got to figure out, you know, that what I'm seeking my whole life has been seeking me. When we walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, I got no idea what really is troubling me is this defective relationship with God that is practically non-existent. Or if I have a relationship with Him, my perception of what God really is skewed. And so I've got to find that way to have this separateness removed. And the truth of the matter is, the only separateness I've ever had from God is my own thinking. I'm the only person who believes I'm separated. I was talking to somebody today about believing in God, and it's the truth. You know, I asked him, I said, well, do you believe in God? And he said, well, I'm not sure. I said, well, just trust this, He believes in you.
Right.
And that's the truth. That's the factual truth. But I'm separated from God on self-will because of all that restless, irritable discontentness. I believe somewhere in there that I can only get what I can get based on what I can do. I don't believe in that there's something going to, some kind of external power is going to help me. That whatever I'm going to get out of this world is going to be derived from my own actions. And this idea that we talk about in step 11, to love, comfort, and understand, I believe that's what you owe me. If you love me more, if you comfort me more, if you understand me more, everything will be all right. Everything will be all right if you do that. The second problem I got here is that I lack power. Now, the thing about lacking power is a guy like me will try to get him, Robert. A guy like me will try to, I'll manufacture false power. And we call those character defects. I'll try to manufacture false power. And maybe you've experienced this. You be somewhere and you see something you really like, so you just take it. You know, you find things before they're lost. That kind of stuff. You know what I mean? Just take it. You know. And then you help people look for it. That's what you do, right? Because you're not a horrible friend. You help them look for it. But what you do is you got one over on them, so you just have this sense of superiority. Mm-hmm. You got one over. You know, you sleep with some girl and you come tell your friends about it. You come brag about it to your friends. You have that moment where you feel like you're the guy. But it's fleeting. It leaves. I cheat somebody out of something. Come back, tell the guys. Or I don't tell anybody. I just have this moment where I feel superior to that. But it's fleeting. It goes away. It's false power. And I learned this about those character defects put into play gives me this sense of power. So I'm trying to create power, which I lack. I absolutely lack power. Character defects help me manufacture false power. And the last thing is because I'm restless, irritable, discontented, you know, what I need is ease and comfort. And if you're new or you're nearly new, or we run into people who are coming in for the very first time, I think it's really important we talk to them about, you know, your restless, irritable, discontent. Listen, seeking ease and comfort is really okay. That's really, because if you're restless, irritable, discontent, you need to be eased and comforted. The trouble is what the textbook says, it talks about we get the sense of ease and comfort. Not real ease and comfort, just the sense of it. That's what we're looking for.
We just want to feel better.
Just for a little bit. We just want to feel better. You ever thought about, you've been restless, irritable, discontent, and you want to, you're going to go score some dough, and just when you make the connection, you just feel better because you know you're about to get it. Go to a bar, get in the parking lot, feel better because you know you're about to get a drink. About to get a drink. Ain't got it yet. About to get it. I feel better. And I'm a guy that believes this about the first three steps. The first three steps are all about me getting right with God. That I've got this pain in life that I'm bringing to the table. And because I've been separated from God on self-will, that I have been running headlong into life trying to manufacture this power. Crushed, as the book says, under the lash of alcoholism. We come here completely defeated. And I think what happens to us is that we have this moment in time where we have this conversation with God. Some people say that prayer, God help me. I can tell you this, when you say the prayer, God help me, I'm going to assure you one thing, he's already on the way. When you utter the prayer, he's already on the way. Maybe a police officer, but that's it, So be careful what you ask for here. Yeah? It's like people say, man, I'm going to pray for patience. I go, get away from me. Because you're going to get some opportunities to practice that, man. Just stand over there. I don't want no blowback from your patience, right? Get over there. And so what happens for a guy like me is I think I have somewhere in here when I come to this point of surrender with enough pain that I begin to have this conversation with God. And I think the conversation looks something like this. As I've been to have this conversation with God, and then it looks like this. So, God, here's the deal, man. I've been separated with you based on self-will. And God says, yeah, I know that. I get that. And he says, well, but look. Are you willing to consider my existence? And under the lash of alcoholism, we say, yeah, I'm willing to consider it. And whether we have considered it, whether we have what the book talks about, have been brought up under some other religion that we learned from somebody else, their idea about God, whatever that might be, we're willing to just say, I'm willing to consider the existence of God. And I think God says, okay, are you willing to take some kind of action to enter into a relationship with me? And I think we throw the dice and say, yeah, I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to take a chance just to see what this is all about. And I think in that moment, when we go through that little conversation with God, I think God says this, we're good. We're good. We're good. We're absolutely good. And I think the next thing he says is, now we're going to look and see who's been sitting in the God chair. Because that's what happens for us. I believe I'm going to need to play God in your life. I've been playing it in my life and everybody around. This idea of coming to believe, this search for the power that it talks about in our book, this idea that I'm powerless, that lack of power is my dilemma. When we turned off the lights tonight to do the song, which by the way was great. I love that. Some point, if this was early tomorrow morning before the sun came up, I'm sure all the lights in here would be out. When we walk in the door, whoever comes in here first tomorrow morning to this dark room, the first thing they're going to do is what? They're going to look for the light switch. If you've never been in the room before, first thing you look for is the light switch. Why? Because you got to get some light on. You got to find the power. I got to find the source of the power in me. And we learn that because when we're little kids, we watched somebody hit a light switch in a dark room and the lights came on. So we learned that, hey, if you hit that switch, the lights come on. And we don't care about I don't need to know, is the water going over a dam in Oklahoma sending all that electrical power out here? I don't need to know, is there a couple of squirrels in a cage out here with some uranium wheeling it out here, man, just trying to turn, running their bottoms off trying to make it. I don't need to know that. I need to know if I hit the switch, did the light come on? That's all I need to know. I don't have to get into why it works, how it works. I don't need to know the theory of electricity. I don't need to know how the wires go. I don't need to know any of that. I need to know when I hit the light switch, does the power come on? And that's what step two is all about. Why I come to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous is what we learn here is from the demonstration of people in here. Our textbook talks about the demonstration of people in Alcoholics Anonymous demonstrated for me the power was possible. It's possible to get on. And they'll help point me to the switch. Because I come in blind, right? I come in the darkness. I don't know where the switch is. People in Alcoholics Anonymous help point us to the switch. I think about this. Back in my using and drinking days, now I'm a real live alcoholic, but I had a slight, very small, almost negligible cocaine deal. almost undetected, really. And one time, about a year before I got sober, I was up at about 4 a.m. on about a 2-day run. And I'm flipping channels. And I hit an infomercial, and there was one for OxyClean. You guys know about this stuff? OxyClean. And it had a pitch man. His name was Billy something or other. I can't remember what it was. And, you know, when you're up for a couple of days, you hit something like that. I just became fascinated by this, man. And Billy's there, and he's got this big clear tub. And it's got all this water swirling around in it. And Billy's giving a pitch for OxyClean. Well, I just moved to the edge of my chair. I mean, he's got me. I'm hooked. I'm watching him, you know. And he's giving the pitch. And he gets a handful of this OxyClean and throws it in the tub. And it's agitating around. He's pitching. And he pulls out this dirty white T-shirt. And he throws it in the tub. And he keeps pitching. And after about a couple minutes, he's talking. He just reaches in and pulls that shirt out. And Shazam. White. All the grass stains. Gone. Well, dude, I'm hooked because I'm looking around sitting in the problem, right? And so what I do, because I hadn't worked in like 3 years, I go back to my wife's, get her purse and get her debit card and order some of that stuff. I got to have it. And it said to me it would be here in 4 to 6 weeks, so I'm patiently waiting. The next morning, I get up and tell Lori that, hey, I've ordered this OxyClean. She wasn't near as excited as I was. But that was her problem, you know, right? And sure enough, the 4 to 6 weeks, it arrived. And I'm going to tell you, I started putting that in the washing machine, and I'm telling you, it worked. And it worked so good, I started putting it in the dishwasher. I just started practicing OxyClean in all my affairs. And it was just great. And then at some point in time, I ran out of OxyClean. Now, when I ran out of OxyClean, I didn't need to go on another 3-day run. I hope to catch Billy back on TV again to watch it, to sell me OxyClean again. By this time, I had some practical experience with OxyClean. And that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you, on that night that I was watching that, if old Billy would have, right in the middle of that, been on about a 2-day run himself and just puked in the tub, I'd have changed the channel. And I think about that experience, and I lay it onto my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think about this. When I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, what am I demonstrating? Am I demonstrating the solution like Billy did that night? Am I demonstrating what the power will do? Am I demonstrating what this omnipotent power has done for me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous? Or am I puking in the tub? So when a newcomer comes in the room, are they going to hear me sell the solution? Or are they going to hear me puke the problem? And the deal about that is if I'm given the solution in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, that new person has an opportunity the same as we've all had. The opportunity to experience the power, the opportunity to have an experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. But if I puke the problem, they're going to turn the channel and walk right out the door and never have an opportunity to experience that. This is what we do here. We give these effective demonstrations. That's what the people of Alcoholics Anonymous demonstrated for me. They demonstrated what the power had done for them. They demonstrated for me how they found the light switch. They talked about that openly, about the solution they had found here. And because of that, what I did, and I think that's what's so important for us, I came to believe that it might work for me too. I don't have to bite the whole inch. A lot of the steps don't talk about that. Steps don't say that I came and believed. It talks about I came to believe. The old timers used to talk about I came to believe. I got here and I began to watch people and demonstrate the solution for me. And I came to believe, hey, that might work for me too. We talk about hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hope here. That's what we deal in. We deal in hope for the new guy when they walk in the door. The only question we ever need to ask anybody about step two, I believe, in my experience, I don't need to ask people anything more than this. Do you hope what's working for me can work for you? And if the answer is yes, we're moving on to step three. We're going to come back and catch all that when we sit down and read the book, and we're going to talk about all that. You know why I think that's so important for us? Why it was so important for me? Because the book says this. This power that we call God, it says we can neither comprehend nor define. And so therefore, it's a rat trap when we say to people, well, describe the power for me. Write down what you think the power is. It's a trap. Because then we begin to put God in a box. We begin to give him these anthropomorphic characteristics that we limit God. And God is limitless. If the book says to me, I can't either comprehend or define, what I want to shelve him. And the trap that most people get into, I believe, in Alcoholics Anonymous, is trying to figure God out. When it tells us, we can't. And so all we have to hear today is to deal in hope. So thanks, guys. I appreciate it.